I'm only glad that I'm talking about demand reduction because I'm just wondering what John's left with after our excellent presentation from the chairman. I think it would be possible to spend an awful lot of the evening agonising over government failure to act quickly enough or decisively enough in respect of demand reduction, just as it would be in respect of generation of energy. But I'm not going to take that approach because I think that it is somewhat bypassing what may be the real issue, that we cannot continue to blame governments alone, even our own government, for a failure to act. It is a collective responsibility in which we're all complicit. And whilst we can see that there may be leadership which would be welcome from certain public bodies, including government and local authorities, without individual action being much more effective and much more widespread and much more radical, we're not going to be able to make any kind of inroads at all into the reduction of demand for energy and the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions associated with electrical generation. So what I'm going to try and talk about are things which are perhaps not particularly predictable in terms of what I might be expected to say, and which are based largely on research that I've been involved in. I should say I'm currently at Cambridge, but I'm an escapee from Imperial College, so there is very little dilution of the Cambridge Imperial axis this evening. If we're going to manage demand, we've got to change a lot of different things. We've got to change behaviour, as I've just been talking about. We've got to change price, and that's a deeply politically difficult area to engage in, because we're constantly hearing about people who are in energy poverty, where more than 10% of their household income is committed to the buying of energy. But it is price is a very effective manipulator of behaviour. We've got to change building fabric if we're going to change the way in which our buildings consume energy, and we've got to change the way in which we manage energy. And when we've done all that, and if we were to do all that highly successfully, there's another problem, and that is that if we spend less, if we demand less by way of electricity and power in general, and we spend less on it as part of our personal incomes, we will be spending that money in other areas. And if the money that we save on energy is money that we then spend on a more carbon-intensive activity, we have gained absolutely nothing. And there is a problem associated with increasing, particularly in a well-to-do society like ours, that when people manage to reduce kind of fixed costs, as it were, the predictable costs associated with everyday living, they tend to travel more, and that is really the last thing we want to encourage people to do. In terms of looking at building retrofit and greenhouse gas emission scenarios, the Department of Energy and Climate Change has for several years had this 2050 UK Pathways Calculator, an extraordinarily elegant model. Of course, it's arguable about what the detail of the predictions of the maths are and whether or not they're all entirely robust and reliable, and whether or not sufficient attention has been given to various forms of generation. But what it does do is to balance supply and demand, generation and demand, and it allows anybody to go on the calculator and to see what the relative impacts of different activities might be, both in terms of generation and in terms of demand. And the opportunities in buildings, in domestic and non-domestic buildings, rely on a certain number of adjustable measures. The average temperature of homes, insulation, the electrification of heating, which is an assumption that, which is based on the assumption that there will be a decarbonisation of the grid over the period between now and 2050, and the possible gains from different lighting appliances. But one of the most extraordinary pieces of information that comes directly from the Pathways Calculator and is something that was identified by the previous scientific advisor at DCLG and the previous scientific advisor at DEC is this figure here. I'm not sure whether you can read the axes there, but this is the percentage of total national greenhouse gas emissions reduction associated with different activities. And what's striking here is that by where it says average room temperature to decrease to 16 degrees, the average room temperature in domestic properties in this country in 2014 was 17.5 degrees. That's averaged over all the rooms in domestic property, which is an extraordinarily high figure. And if we were to reduce it by 1.5 degrees as an average, we would reduce the national greenhouse gas emissions by 9%. That's without any change to fabric and without any change to legislation and without any change to anything physical, that behaviour change alone has a really significant effect. And that's compared to, that's the 1.5 degree reduction, takes you back to what the average room temperature was in 2007. If you went back to what the average room temperature was in 1980, you would get probably another 9%. It's quite extraordinary that this effect could be achieved, which is why the government has become so interested and so commits so much resources and thought to the whole concept of nudge and behaviour change. But that's not to say that building fabric improvements is not an incredibly important part of the equation as well. And there's not total additionality, but there is a certain amount of additionality between these figures. So improved domestic heating supply by electricity, assuming the decarbonisation goes according to plan, is one aspect, and energy demand reduction in lighting appliances is another major feature. And, of course, there are inherent uncertainties in this, which are here, and I won't go through these in detail because there's too many, but there are a number of inherent uncertainties associated with any modelling and prediction, and they're kind of intuitive. One of the most significant ways that there are uncertainties associated with is the way in which building fabric is actually installed and fitted. And it's a very serious problem that we're currently engaged in quite serious research in, and as many others are at many other universities, looking at the effectiveness of the insulation process. Because buildings account for 40% of energy use in most countries, and 87% of existing buildings in this country are expected still to be here in 2050. So we have a retrofit, a refurbishment challenge, which is very significant, much greater than it is in most younger economies. Process, the easy parts of that process have already been addressed. We've already done the cavity wall insulation to a certain degree. We had the introduction of the Green Deal was a brave new attempt, probably somewhat badly architected, but it was a brave attempt to try and get into the next generation of retrofitting, and the backpedalling on that in government is not particularly welcome. But there are the hard-to-treat properties, which I think are on the next slide. The hard-to-treat properties are the properties like these, which have solid walls. They're off the gas network. They include high-rise buildings, buildings with no availability for loft insulation. These, using conventional methods, these buildings are not easy to treat and they're not cost-effective to upgrade. There have to be other incentives and tariffs to try and encourage behaviour change. There's been quite a lot of interesting work in retrofitting the domestic built environment and some, what we described as socio-technical research, trying to fit sociological norms to technical solutions has been done. Retrofit 2050 is worth having a look at the work. That website is still up and running. And what this research did was to look forward to 2050 and say, what are the credible scenarios which we might be working with in terms of what the built environment might look like and what society might expect of us? And it's very important to do that futures work, that scenario planning, because it affects the way in which we do refurbishment and insulation and fabric upgrades now. If we don't think about where the potential future direction is of household size, urban density, attitudes to energy consumption, the political environment, and so on, we will run the risk of making very poor decisions. And this work was done using two areas, one in an area in Cardiff and South East Wales, and one in Manchester. And it looked at some very interesting angles in terms of research. One of the things that it looked at in some considerable detail was the barriers and motivations and demographics of people making choices about energy and energy efficiency. And it was slightly counterintuitive that the findings did not play out according to what you might expect, that the well-off were more concerned about energy efficiency as a kind of additional feature of responsibility, and the less well-off were less concerned. It didn't play out that way at all. And actually, the greatest benefit accrues in terms of retrofitting properties to the less well-off, because they generally have a greater consciousness about their cost of energy, and they are generally less well-served by their thermal environment, as it were, so that when they do get a retrofit, they allow a certain amount of increase in their winter room temperatures because they have been living below a kind of optimal figure. So the savings that you accrue don't, the greenhouse gas savings accrue not to the great to the extent that you would expect, but the standard of living and the quality of life does increase. So it becomes rather a complicated equation. And it works against this simple approach that in terms of just retrofitting buildings is going to give you greenhouse gas emission reductions, doesn't work out as you would expect. The viewpoints across towards energy consumption cut across many different aspects. Some people are worried about the cost, actually surprisingly few. Some people are very proactive about energy conservation and regard it very seriously. The majority of people are extremely passive about it and have an apathetic attitude. And there's a relative minority of people, although it's obviously not represented in the room here, who are concerned about the environmental consequences of their energy consumption. The energy efficiency gap, of course, is one that obsesses people who get involved in large-scale development of housing and mixed developments. And it amounts to not just a gap between what is predicted and what eventuates, but also that all of the regulated energy is not all of the energy that is used in buildings. So the regulated energy is what is controlled by regulation and legislation, but actually it's probably about a third of the total energy use in buildings. And another area which has been very interesting is that a very significant percentage of the buildings in this country are subject to some form of heritage protection. We have grade one, grade two star, and grade two listed buildings, but we also have conservation areas. And buildings which are covered by these protections have, through what was English Heritage, have very strong constraints placed on them in terms of what can be done in terms of retrofitting for improved energy efficiency. And I'm not suggesting that places like King's College Chapel in Cambridge should be externally lined with polyurethane panels, but there are, and it's been estimated that just the administration buildings of Cambridge University, which are all listed, would take £8 million to retrofit and would save about £100,000 a year, so it's not entirely cost-effective. But there are ways in which a certain amount of retrofitting could be very effective, and what this research showed was that developers regard planning as a significant barrier to improved retrofitting of historic and conserved buildings. Cost was obviously also a major concern, but what really concerned these people, and this work was done for Grosvenor in Mayfair and Belgravia, you can see the yellow are buildings which are protected, and the red line outlines the conservation area, and conservation area being within a conservation area provides a constraint as well, showed that the amount of inconsistency between the permissions given by different local authorities and even different officers within a local authority, and the inconsistency and, in fact, a lack of cohesion between planning legislation and energy efficiency guidance constrained an awful lot of activity, and many developers see no particular mileage in being able to pursue this. So there's a strong lack of integration between energy efficiency and conservation objectives, a lack of certainty on appropriate energy efficiency measures, and a lack of consistency. It's not a great story. And it's a significant percentage of the building stock in this country. It's not 1 or 2%. It's well over 15%. And this study was done only in the 14 inner London boroughs, where you would expect a degree of consistency, which just is not there. The last area of interest, I feel as though I'm coming up with a list of depressing facts. The last area of interest, this is the most depressing, is the health estate. So there's 17 million square meters of health estate in this country. It's a very large estate, this was a project given by the Department of Health. £50 million were given to 50 hospitals to do energy efficiency, demand reduction, almost all in demand reduction schemes, which they could choose. And our work was to go and evaluate how effective all this work had been. And as a result of that work, we revised the Health Technical Memorandum 0702, HTM 0702, and some quite interesting work has been done around that. But the findings of that work was that the constant cuts in the public service in places like the National Health Service, cutting doctors and nurses is unpopular, cutting back of house staff is invisible. And so the estate management facilities and functions in most hospitals has been severely cut back, such that the energy management skills vary widely is a euphemism for are largely absent. And many people with decades of experience have been let go, such that the knowledge about really complex estates is now absent. Trust with energy efficiency master plans, some of the better organized ones, had projects that they could release straight away and did well. Short time scales were completely unrealistic. The ERIC data, for those of you who work in this area, is public data, but actually many hospitals have a single meter. And if it, like somewhere like Southampton, you've got 6,000 people working on site, one or even 10 meters doesn't give you very much granularity in the data. So in conclusion, demand reduction is absolutely crucial, and we don't take it nearly seriously enough because we think that we need to serve the public by supplying the demand that comes forward. We've done that in transport, and we've got into a tremendous amount of difficulty. Solutions are complex. Social change can contribute and must be taken more seriously. Physical measures are significant but complicated. The quality of physical remedies is absolutely crucial. Systems often are in conflict with each other, and policies in the current government are weakening to the point of disappearance. Thank you very much.
Who is next? Thank you very much.